From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out this week. I'm Frank Browning. Today on Fresh Air, acting, pretending, and being a star with Daisy Egan, the young heroine of the new Broadway show, The Secret Garden. She talks to us with her father, actor Richard Egan. Also, we meet an astronomer with a mission, John Dobson, otherwise known as the Sidewalk Astronomer. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the original All-American Sousa, a collection of John Philip Sousa marches. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A steady stream of trucks, trailers, and buses made their way across the Turkish-Iraqi border today, carrying Kurdish refugees back to their country. Malcolm Brabant reports from the Iraqi border town of Zako.
1 minute, the mountain track was dry. A few hours later, it resembled a Somme battlefield. That was the description given by a Royal Marine officer whose trucks were unable to make it through the mud. Royal Marines Colonel Jonathan Thompson was delighted that the refugees felt confident enough to return.
You may recall a few days ago when we kicked out the secret police and chased the rest out of town, and I think they are now happy about that.
Right.
And this is really the result of that. It was the inevitable result that we're seeing the sort of the dam of humanity really sort of bursting. That doesn't sound too stupid. And they're all just going to roll down the mountain.
Helicopters arrived late in the day to help shuttle the refugees down. The Marines estimate that the mountain should be empty within a day or so.
Malcolm Brabant reporting for the BBC. Allied forces have expanded the safe haven zone that's designed to protect Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq. The American commander on the Turkish-Iraqi border said that the security zone will be expanded eastward in preparation for a second temporary refugee camp at the town of Amadiya. Amadiya is about 40 miles east of Zako, the site of the first safe haven camp. Allied officials said that Iraq has been told to withdraw its security forces from the area and not to interfere with the Allied operation. In El Salvador, a new National Assembly has been sworn in. For the first time, the left is represented. Meanwhile, more than 10,000 leftist supporters took part in a march to celebrate May Day. Tom Gibb reports.
It was the largest May Day march for a number of years. The leftist deputies, taking seats for the first time, swore before the crowd to uphold popular interests. Just before the formal opening of the new 80-seat assembly, the founder of the right-wing Arena Party, Major Roberto Dabuisson, welcomed the arrival of the left. Dabuisson even voted for the leftist leader, Ruben Zamora, to be assembly vice president. In recent weeks, there's been a great deal of optimism that an end to the war is coming. One of the first points before the new assembly will be to ratify a package of constitutional reforms agreed by the government and guerrillas in peace talks. The talks themselves are due to continue later this month. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Stock prices shot up today on Wall Street as leading banks began dropping their prime lending rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 42 points to close at 2930.2. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 2-to-1 in active trading. This is NPR News. Israeli Housing Minister Ariel Sharon conferred privately today with HUD Secretary Jack Kemp in a meeting that was downgraded because of Sharon's opposition to U.S. policy in the Middle East. Sharon is an outspoken advocate of expanding Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. The U.S. says new settlements are hindering progress toward Arab-Israeli peace talks. The Washington Post reported that Secretary of State James Baker suggested that it wouldn't be appropriate for a cabinet member to meet officially with Sharon. Today's private meeting took place at the Israeli embassy in Washington. A chemical plant explosion in northeast Louisiana has forced the evacuation of an entire town. Sunny Merriweather of member station KEDM has more.
The town of Sterlington has been evacuated after an explosion and fire at the IMC fertilizer plant. Ouachita Parish Sheriff's Major Tillman Brown says the explosion occurred shortly after 1:30 and blew out windows at an elementary school and in homes.
We don't have any confirmed fatalities. There are some confirmed injuries, and they are going to the local hospitals in the area.
There are unconfirmed reports that two plant workers are missing. Brown says officials on the scene ordered the evacuation because of fear that chemicals at the plant might be released. But he says so far there's no confirmation that any have been, although it is reported that anhydrous ammonia has leaked from the plant. For National Public Radio, I'm Sunny Merriweather in Louisiana.
Lebanese soldiers moved out today to dismantle some of the military fortifications left from the country's 16-year civil war. 5,000 Lebanese troops moved into the areas formerly controlled by Druze and Christian militias. Soldiers from the two sectarian groups withdrew as the regular army approached. They were urged to comply by Druze leader Wali Jumblatt and Christian militia chief Shamir Jaja. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Daisy Egan is 11 years old. For as long as she can remember, she's played pretend games with her stuffed animals, with her parents, with imaginary creatures. Now, 5 nights and 3 afternoons a week, she walks onto the big stage of the St. James Theater on Broadway and plays the biggest pretend game of her young life, the orphan child Mary Lennox in Mary Frances Hodgson's The Secret Garden. Daisy Egan started acting with her actor father, Richard Egan. Welcome to Fresh Air, Daisy and Richard.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Daisy, we've known each other, oh, I don't know, what, about 10 years? And I realized I'd be back on the East Coast doing this show, and I wanted to see you on Broadway. I mean, of course, you'd been on Broadway before. Your debut was as young Cosette in Les Misérables. Now you're starring in The Secret Garden. What's it feel like to be a star?
What does it feel like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very exciting, but sometimes it's hard because I don't get that much sleep. And sometimes people, you know, sort of, some people want to be my friends and then some people don't want to be, because some people just think that since I'm on Broadway, I'm going to be like a little starlet kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
So they just don't want to get to know me. But then some people, you know, they'll say, oh, will you be my friend? So.
You mean just out among the neighbors, among the neighbor kids?
Or? Yeah. And school and everything like that. But all in all, it's pretty exciting, I think.
Had you read The Secret Garden before you did this show?
Oh, yeah. I've read it 5 times or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
I've read it, well, my mother read it to me once, and then I read it again for a book report, and then I read it again, and that's 3, and then I read it again. And, but I think that's all. Yeah, 4 times.
Real briefly,
yes.
Just like in a few sentences, what's the story of The Secret Garden?
Well, a little orphaned girl whose parents died of the cholera goes to live with her Uncle Archibald in Misselthwaite Manor in England. And she finds her cousin, who is supposed to be crippled, and she finds a garden and makes her cousin well again and makes her uncle happy because his wife had died, and she makes him feel happier.
Richard, what's it feel like when people come up and say, oh, you must be Daisy's dad, the father of the star?
Well, that's kind of funny. I have always been Daisy's father, and I will always be Daisy's father. But right now, I seem to be enjoying a kind of mini familial celebrity. Oh, you're Daisy's father! And I am extremely happy and very, very proud. It makes me feel just as big as the sun. I feel wonderful, Frank.
Well, of course, you're an actor, too. You're not on Broadway. I mean, you work in rep companies.
That's right.
And only in the last few years have you returned to acting after, what, almost 20 years away from the stage.
That's right.
Do you ever feel just a little bit jealous?
Of course. I used to say to Daisy, if you get a Broadway production contract before I do, I'll break your spindly little legs. But lo and behold, that came
about. But he didn't.
No, I sure didn't. Yes, I've been through some ups and downs over that. But lately, things have been coming my way in a real way, in a very satisfying way. I was very glad to be able to give Daisy her start and to see her kind of take her own wing. And now for me, I've been working with this repertory company uptown, but more importantly, I've got some of my own work, which I'm about to debut, and Daisy takes a very keen interest in what I'm doing, and I think is just as proud of me as I am of her.
Daisy, you made your theatrical debut with Richard at the Brooklyn Academy of Music just a little over 2 years ago in a version of The Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Did you always have fantasies about acting? Acting seem to be?
Well, first I wanted to be a ballerina, but I saw my dad in Kid Twist, and I thought it was really neat that he could be like another person, so I wanted to try it out. And then, you know, my parents are scanning through backstage and they see this, audition for Tiny Tim's Christmas Carol. So I go and I audition for a very small part, and they ask me if I would read for Tiny Tim. And then my father read with me as Bob Cratchit. And then they called us back about 2 weeks later and they asked us how we would like to be in the show. And I was so overjoyed. I was very excited.
Well, it was pretty exciting, actually.
I was glad to work with my father.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is acting?
What is acting?
Mm-hmm.
Acting is, well, as Jodie Foster puts it, it's pretending. And that's what I like to think of it, because it's more fun to pretend than to act, I think.
What's pretending?
Pretending is when you pretend. It's like when you, you know, you make up something in your head and then you go with it, and you don't rehearse it, you just do it. And then acting is sort of the same thing, except usually you have a script to go with and you go with it. But I suppose, I mean, it's sort of the same, but it's in many ways different.
Well, now you have a friend. Maybe he's a pretend friend, Harald.
Yeah.
Who is Harald? And he always comes to your place.
Yes, he's my stuffed rabbit. You know, he's not a real stuffed rabbit. He's like a toy stuffed rabbit, and he goes. Well, if I go on like overnight trips, he's got to come with me. Or I don't sleep.
He'd get lonely?
Yeah.
And you?
I'd get lonely, too.
Hmm. And so he's one of your pretend friends?
Yeah. My father helps me out with conversations with him.
Yes, I would take objection to calling him a pretend friend.
Yeah.
Oh?
Oh, he's quite real. He's a character who, through kind of pretend playing, has taken on almost a life of his own around the house.
Do his voice, Dad.
He's not here.
Oh,
but you can still do his voice.
No, Harald is not here. He's actually in the dressing room at the St. James at the moment.
I see.
Yes.
Now, did he was in the audience for opening night at the Secret
Garden.
Yes,
he was. And he enjoyed it very much.
What did he tell you about it?
He said he loved it and that I was wonderful and that the whole play was great. And that he was tired. He was tired because he went to the party and everything. So
what happened at the party?
Oh, nothing much. We danced and we... Oh, and my parents, they celebrated their 23rd anniversary, wedding anniversary. And I got them a cake at Pazzo Bakery. And it was a raspberry chocolate cake with whipped cream toppings. And I went over the mic and I said... I announced it, and we all sang Happy Anniversary, and then they made their speeches, and then we had cake, and it was delicious.
Well, now, Richard, yours and Andrea's anniversary was actually, I mean, that recalls a fairly famous event.
Well, yes.
I mean, you and she were in Life magazine because of your wedding, weren't
indeed,
you?
Indeed, yes. It's an event which reverberates, and people still remember. We were married first behind the barricaded doors of Fairweather Hall at Columbia University during the student strike in 1968, an event which was participated in by most of the people on campus at the time, just the night before we were all arrested. When Andrea was being escorted to the paddy wagons, everybody sang, "Here Comes the Bride." And then we were married again just a bit later with a formal ceremony for the family. So we're lucky we have two anniversaries. But they were both celebrated by Daisy on the night of the Secret Garden opening party. It was quite nice and really thoughtful.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
My guests are Daisy Egan, star of The Secret Garden, now on Broadway, and her father, actor Richard Egan. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Richard and Daisy Egan. Richard is Daisy's father. They are both actors. Daisy in the current and new Broadway show, The Secret Garden. How much does Daisy's life kind of run the family life right now?
Well, it certainly is a major factor in what we do with our time. You know, when I left the business back in the 60s, I never thought I would see it again. I just really turned my back on the theater. And it's an odd thing to have seen it come to this, that I have a career in the theater, that she has a career in the theater. I mean, we've become a theatrical family, and it's odd, and it sits well with us. I mean, we enjoy it. Yet we, all of us, have the time and the expanse to do what we are doing.
And we always make sure that there's time that at least once a month that we can all get together and, like, have a regular conversation. Because then, like, most, like, you know, children and their families, when the children have a career, you know, with whatever, they usually don't talk. And then their families start to just, like, slow down. And, you know, it's like a slowed down metabolism. And, you know, you just, like, lose interest in each other, and then
you still have time to, you know, to play and to sing and to fight and to get on each other's nerves and to have a good time and
yeah. All of those things.
We're a
yes.
regular fam. Well, sort of.
We're planting a garden this spring.
And, yeah, it's a beautiful garden.
Yeah.
No secrets in the garden.
No. Mm. Well, one or two.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Mm. But sometimes you don't know about those until they reveal themselves.
Mm. When you left acting, Richard,
yes.
you for a while you were a carpenter,
yeah.
and then you were an artist,
yeah.
and then you spent a little bit of time reopening the Fun House at Coney Island and organizing or being a part of the Coney Island Hysterical Society.
That's right.
I mean, Coney Island, one might say, is almost a life obsession with you, right?
Yes, in a way, it did become that. There's a secret that didn't reveal itself, for example, until I was older. I used to spend a lot of time there, having grown up in Brooklyn, with my grandfather. And I, in the early 80s, I had a series of dreams about Coney Island, a very intense series of dreams. And it led me to going back there to see what it was about that place and getting together with some other artists and performers and forming the Coney Island Hysterical Society. And I spent 4 or 5 seasons down there doing a lot of different things. We rejuvenated this old fun house, and then I worked as an agent weight guesser, and I was a barker on a live thrill show. I kept coming back season after season for just a little bit more until I finally got so punchy that I couldn't stand it. It was life perhaps a little bit too much in the fast lane.
But that life also in some ways seems like it has brought you back into the theater, and you've mentioned I guess it's more like a performance theater piece that you're working on. That's come out of the Coney Island experience?
Yes, actually, two things in Coney Island have led to my return to the theater. One is that People ask me to tell stories about what it was like to be on the Midway and to be in that life in Coney Island. And there were many, many stories to tell. At the same time...
Stories of what sort of people?
Oh, stories of my encounters with the Coney Island old-timers, a lot of whom are gone now. So all of this has come together for me in a performance piece, as you said, which has grown into a play called Alive on the Inside, which I've been doing at performance spaces and clubs around the city. And I'm about to mount in its fullest version up at Avalon Repertory Theater on Broadway at 105th Street.
So you'll both be on Broadway, though rather different Broadways.
Yes, yes, we will. Hopefully someday we'll be down the street from each other and be able to...
There'll be the two Egan theaters. There'll be the Richard Egan and the Daisy Egan. And we'll both be on 46th Street.
Oh, there's looking ahead.
Yeah. Well, you're not modest in your dreams.
Well, it's all developed really far past, I guess, what we would have dreamed some years ago, Frank.
Daisy.
Yes?
When the curtain has fallen and they've shuffled you off into the car and you're back in Brooklyn, upstairs, in your room, and you're trying to go to sleep, what kind of things come to mind?
Scary things sometimes. I think, oh my gosh, is the show going to run? And sometimes I think, what if it doesn't? What will I do? Will I go back to school? Will I audition for more things? Will I just lose interest? Will I become a regular kid again? And sometimes I think, well, you know, how long is it going to be until I leave the show? And then I wonder what's going to happen then.
So how do you get to sleep at last?
Geez. Well, I read. That's a lot of what I do. And I lie there just thinking, and then I like try to stay awake until my eyes are so tired that I have to just close them and drift off. And sometimes my mother will tell me a story about the beach or whatever, and my dad has Harold talk to me sometimes. So, and sometimes I'm just so tired I can barely even say goodnight, so I'm just like, goodnight. But...
Zonked.
Yeah, but a lot of the times I'm lying awake thinking a lot. So I just started drinking, like, warm milk. But sometimes that doesn't even help because I'm really, like, tense, like, oh, my God, biting on my nails, just thinking and wondering.
You know, I wondered something when I was thinking about the plays you've been in. The three big ones, right? Tiny Tim. You were in Les Miserables.
Yes.
As young Cosette. Mm-hmm. And here you are in The Secret Garden as Mary Lennox. Now, these are kids, for sure, but they all lived a very long time ago in a very different kind of life that really has nothing to do with the way kids live now. How do you make up their characters? I mean, you get the lines, but how do you find out who they really are?
Well, how do I find out who they really are? Well, I don't know. I just think about it a lot. I make up my own story. And, you know, I'll go through the script and make up, you know, well, what would have happened if this happened? Or what would have happened if he hadn't interrupted the scene? And I just keep on going with that. And, like, sometimes when I'm lying in bed at night, you know, I make up, well, you know, what happened before they showed this scene? What was her life like? And once for school, I wrote the part of young Cosette for my own, like, script for Les Mis. And
you made up your own story.
Yeah, but just for the Cosette part, not for, like, the whole thing.
What kind of stories did you make up about Mary Lennox, the little girl in The Secret Garden? Of course, now, her family was in India, and she was with them, and then the cholera wiped everyone else out besides her. Have you made up stories about Lennox?
Yeah, I've made up, like, well, at the end of the story, my mother I reach out for her because she's leaving, and she says, she's trying to say, I love you for the first time, and I'm sorry for whatever I've done. But she still can't because she's dead now, and she's tried, and there's, like, I've made up a time where, like, I've seen my mother, you know, I've sort of opened her room door and was looking at her, and she turned her head my way, and she got the most mean look on her face, and I got terrified, and I slammed the door, and I, like, tried to hide, but she, like, found me, and she started yelling at me, and she, like, got really upset, and I got upset, and then I was told I had to be kept away, and my mother didn't want to see me at all, and I was very upset, and everyone tried to coax me, but I'd just start screaming and yelling, but I think deep down, Mary Lennox is a wonderful child, but she had no one to tell her that, so she couldn't find it in herself until Martha comes along saying, hey, you know, you're fine. You just gotta look at yourself from a different position.
Had you heard that story before, Richard, about how she developed the character?
Daisy started talking about that with me not long ago, and I asked her where she had been advised to do that. Was it in her acting classes at the Neighborhood Playhouse, or whether her director gave it to her, and she said basically she came up with it by herself.
And what did you say?
Some of us spend hundreds upon hundreds of dollars with technique classes to get to that point. It's amazing. It's just amazing.
You think you'll ever be as good an actor as Daisy, Richard?
I'm glad that
she is as good as an
actor. I'm glad I have a role model now, I'll tell you that.
No, I'm as good as an actor as he is. That's how I put it.
No, but I insist.
No, I insist.
It is wonderful.
Because I think that, I mean, my father is the one that got me going. I mean, if I didn't go to see his show and if I didn't have him, then I would be totally different. I'd have no idea of who I really am because he's helped me out so much. So, you know, and it would be so hard without him. And he's the one he's always given me, like, little tips and little, you know, I've asked him, Dad, could you please give me a little acting class? And he'd, you know, say, okay, you're at a train station, and, you know, we'd go from there. And so he's the best father anyone could ever have.
As for my part, Frank, I have to say that I'm in a remarkably lucky position to be able to see someone who brings it from her imaginative life, and out of whom it springs naturally, to have that as an inspiration. For me, I mean, I have technique, but really what we all need at the base of it is to be able to play. I mean, that's why they call it a play.
Daisy Egan?
Yes?
Richard Egan?
Oh.
I want to thank you for being on Fresh Air. Daisy Egan is starring at the moment in the Broadway play The Secret Garden, and Richard Egan is also an actor who is working on a number of pieces, and including a performance piece that will be in New York sometime this summer. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Terry Gross is out this week. Maybe you don't notice the stars in the sky at night. Maybe you can't even see the stars. Maybe you need a telescope. If so, then sidewalk astronomer John Dobson is the man for you. He travels the country with his telescope, showing the night sky to those of us who haven't had a proper introduction yet. Coming up, a talk with John Dobson. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release of John Philip Sousa Marches. It includes some recordings of the maestro himself from 70 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Estimates of the number of people killed in Bangladesh by Monday's cyclone are rising sharply. The government says that nearly 3,000 bodies have been recovered, but officials admit this figure is not final. Relief workers put that number much higher. Sam Miller filed this report for the BBC from the capital, Dhaka.
The Red Crescent official, Mr. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, speaking by radio telephone from the island of Sundweep near Chittagong, said he believed more than 6,000 islanders had been killed by the cyclone. He said he had personally counted hundreds of bodies. Other heavily populated areas have been devastated, with another 1,000 dead now reported from the island of Kutubdia. Communications with the region remain almost non-existent, and it's still difficult for the government and relief officials in Dhaka to get a clear picture of the scale of the disaster. Relief work has begun, with the Red Crescent sending dry foods, tarpaulins, water purification tablets, medicine to those parts of the affected areas which are most easily accessible.
Sam Miller reporting for the BBC. The Angolan government and the guerrilla force UNITA, which has battled the government with American and South African backing, have signed an agreement today to end their 16-year civil war. The 1,500-page accords call for an internationally monitored ceasefire to take effect in June and for the first multi-party elections in the fall of 1992. The shuttle Discovery is being photographed from space at this hour. A technical glitch which had postponed testing by a Star Wars satellite has now been repaired. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The Star Wars satellite was scheduled to begin operation this morning, but ground controllers were unable to point the satellite in the correct position. The sun is used as a reference point, but officials believe that the satellite shut itself down for protection after seeing either direct sunlight or a reflection of itself. Technicians have worked around the problem and are now able to point the satellite correctly. The Defense Department hardware will gather data from the shuttle's exhaust plumes in space, which could lead to the identification of enemy ballistic missiles in space. Technical problems have caused the Air Force to eliminate between 15 and 20% of the scheduled experiments on board Discovery. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
A spokesman for the main Yankee nuclear power plant says that a hydrogen fire in the plant Monday evening was probably caused by a transformer failure. It could keep the plant closed for months. Plant officials have been criticized by regulators for their handling of the catastrophe. The night of the fire, officials confirmed that a fire had broken out, but gave no indication of its severity. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow advanced 42 points to close at 2930.20. Advances led declines in active trading of 182 million shares. This is NPR. The BBC is reporting that Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani says that Iraqi officials have agreed to abolish the ruling Revolutionary Command Council and hold multi-party elections within 6 months. Talabani, a member of the Iraqi Kurdistan Front, says that negotiations are still going on. He and a delegation of other Kurdish leaders reached agreement last week with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein on autonomy for the Kurds. Talabani says that a new, freely elected parliament will function instead of all other bodies. President Bush today wrote to members of Congress to assure them their concerns over possible American job losses and environmental damage would be addressed in a proposed free trade pact with Mexico. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from the White House.
Labor groups worry that the proposed trade agreement might mean American jobs will go south. Environmentalists are concerned that lax Mexican controls might mean more pollution on the border. The president hopes he has addressed those concerns in a letter sent to some members of Congress today. In a speech to business writers, Mr. Bush said the administration will ensure what he called an adequate transition period for workers in import-sensitive industries.
We will work with Congress to see that dislocated workers receive proper assistance and retraining. I believe we have the answers to the questions that are being raised by the labor unions and by some on Capitol Hill.
The president also said that the U.S. will expand environmental cooperation programs with Mexico and said Mexico has no interest in becoming a pollution haven for U.S. companies. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The federal government says that Pfizer Incorporated will pay $3.1 million for water pollution violations. The fine is part of an agreement filed in a Philadelphia federal court. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh says the action comes because Pfizer was fined for dumping large amounts of ammonia and iron oxide into the Delaware River for 6 years. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Now, if there were a million amateur astronomers with telescopes, and they were willing to let a few thousand people each look through their telescopes, there would be a chance for all the people in this world who wanted to see to see.
Usually, astronomy is thought of as one of the big-ticket exotic sciences. But John Dobson, now 75, calls himself a sidewalk astronomer. Once a Vedantin monk, Dobson left the cloistered life more than 40 years ago and began dragging around a simple telescope to lure curious kids into the mysteries of the heavens. He's one of the scientists featured on the six-part PBS series, The Astronomers. And he doesn't think much of the way most school kids learn about the stars by memorizing sets of constellations.
To me, the whole notion of constellations is kind of a pain in the neck. I really am not much into constellations. And they turned out to be very confusing to the astronomers. They had to have a big international meeting someplace in Europe to find out exactly where the borders of all these constellations were. Because if you give the designation, if you give a place designation, you see, according to constellation, you can't have the constellations overlap. So anyway, I don't see all those pictures up there. But you find your way around the sky by knowing where Orion is and knowing that the dagger handle points toward the North Star. And you know the Big Dipper, and you know where the pointer stars are. And you know Scorpio and a few things like that. I do know a few constellations. It's not as though I'm completely retarded, but I don't use them much. And I don't like to talk about all those stories.
So how do you get people interested in the heavens? I mean, I gather, to some degree, you'd like to describe the stars and the heavens as rice pudding?
That was for the universe as a whole. That's an illustration of the Big Bang model. The Big Bang model has the expansion of the universe explained as an explosion, the leftover motion from an explosion, which was 15 billion years or so ago, and all the matter of the universe was involved in that explosion, and that's why all the distant things are going away. And that can be compared, and it's not originally my comparison, can be compared to a raisin pudding in the oven. And as the pudding gets bigger and bigger, the raisins get lonelier and lonelier. As I say, so if you come too late for dinner, you get only one raisin in your spoon. But the
In your spoon. Follow
the
metaphor.
Yeah, because the raisins get lonelier, you see. But you see, the steady state model has new raisins springing up in between. So as the raisins get lonelier and lonelier, a new raisin spring up in between. So don't make no. Never mind how late you come for dinner. There's seven or eight raisins to your spoon.
Tell us what you mean about the universe.
Well, actually, you see, when you think of these cosmological models and you see that the universe is expanding, it's not that the galaxies are getting farther and away from each other, but the clusters of galaxies appear to be getting away from each other. The raisins in our pudding are not galaxies and certainly not stars, and not even clusters of stars. They would be clusters of galaxies. On a large, large scale, the universe is expanding, but within a cluster of galaxies, we think the galaxies are not going away from each other.
But now, many of your fellow academic astronomers, when you have made these presentations, have said, well, he's a good educator, but he's a little bit out of his depth here, and a few of you have walked out of the room.
Well, I'm not very orthodox. Partly because I don't think that the observational evidence supports the Big Bang very well. They have the whole universe arising from this explosion, and the explosion seems to have been very, very smooth. And the big problem is, how do you get a lumpy universe out of such a smooth explosion? Now, recently we've discovered that when we look at the universe on the very largest scales, we find that it's the lumpiest we've ever discovered. That is to say, the matter in the universe has clumped into enormous clumps with enormous emptinesses between the clumps, and on a very large scale. And the difficulty is to explain how such a huge scale accumulation of matter could take place in such a short length of time if the Big Bang explosion was smooth. That is the big problem facing the Big Bang model right now. But there are other problems that have faced it before.
So you're the loyal skeptic. You don't throw it out altogether. But you have big questions.
I don't care really whether the universe is a Big Bang model or whether it's a steady state model. The big problem as I see it is why we see a universe at all. And what is this energy? The universe is made out of energy, and everybody knows in the physics world that we have no source for energy. We have no way to get rid of any energy, and we have no way to generate energy. We're stuck with what energy there is in the universe without an explanation of what it is or where it came from. Now, to me, that is a serious problem.
My guest is astronomer John Dobson, who has spent his life looking at, contemplating the heavens, and getting other people interested in them, too. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. John Dobson is my guest. You know, one of your friendly critics said, you know, Dobson, he's a born scientist, but the problem is he wants to reconcile religion with astronomy, and he thinks he's got the secret of the universe.
Then
science really doesn't have any room for metaphysics.
Well, you see, it does have room for metaphysics. You see, science is about how the universe works. And if you're going to assume all the first things, then you can go on and call yourself a scientist. What you have to assume is that the energy is there. You're not going to talk about what the energy is. You're not going to talk about where the energy came from, you see. That's why I used that raisin pudding example, you see. The Big Bang people don't have any source for the raisins in their raisin pudding, even though they put them all in at the beginning. The steady state people don't have any source for their raisins, even though they put them in one at a time. The problem is, where does the energy come from of which the universe is made? Now, I can't just assume all those things. Now, for the most part, the physicists have decided, the physicists and the scientists in general, have decided that we'll talk about the hows of physics and not the whys of physics. But I think the why questions are still in there. You ask, see, somebody asks, why does the electron stay near the proton? So it's because one has a plus charge and one has a minus charge. There is still the why question. Why does one have a plus charge and one have a minus charge? And why do plus and minus like each other? And why do pluses and pluses hate each other? There are all these why questions left underneath. And you ask a kid, why does something fall to the floor? He says, because of gravity. Gravity is the name of the problem, not the solution. The problem is, why is matter attracted to matter? Why is there such a thing as gravity? That's what I see as the real problems behind some of the real problems behind our physics. And because I'm willing to look at those problems, they call me a metaphysician, and like on a cigarette butt, they twist their foot and go.
But I have to give the scientists their due. I mean, the scientists are quite upfront. They say their business is how. They say their business is to describe how the clock works, not why we want a clock.
That is correct. This was more or less decided long ago by Sir Isaac Newton. he wrote a lot more theological treatises than he did physics treatises. His physics treatises became famous, and his theological treatises went to the wastebasket, I think, mostly. But at any rate, he separated in his mind the how questions for physics and the why questions for church.
Hmm. Well, when you go off to the public parks,
yeah,
at a more pragmatic level, and you bring your telescope along, what happens? What do people do? What do they say? What do they look for?
Oh, well, it depends on where we are. To a large extent, people jump up and down in glee when they get to see these things. In San Francisco, they destroyed one of the garbage cans that I used to use for a ladder by jumping up and down in joy when they saw Saturn. Now, in the national parks, where it's really dark, you can show star clusters and galaxies and gaseous envelopes around old stars. You can show a whole lot of things. We usually show the brighter objects. But for the most part, maybe one quarter of the people are flabbergasted when they see those things. There's a certain proportion of the population for whom these views are not very important, but there's a smaller proportion of people for whom it is extremely important that they got to see something outside of our solar system.
Well, but for those people who are doubtful at first, it must be, you must have an extraordinary sense of breakthrough when the doubters take a peek and see a universe they never imagined.
Well, some people, of course, are so skeptical that they don't think that what they saw through the telescope is real. I mean, quite often this happens, and then occasionally I'll get the telescope off on some distant apartment house or someplace where you can see a TV screen through the window. They know what programs are showing, and so then they know, by gum, it really is real. Then they want to see it again. Then I have to get it back on Saturn again, you see. And I also have to talk to these people about how far away these things are. While they're looking at Saturn through the telescope, I tell them that if you had a real good Mercedes diesel, and if you drove towards Saturn 60 miles an hour all day and all night without stopping for 1,200 years, you could see Saturn like that with your bare eyes.
Now, that's a technique. And
if you tell them how many miles away, there's nothing they can do in their guts that helps them on miles. But if you tell them how long it would take to drive somewhere near it in a car, that they can somehow handle. But nobody can handle 1,200 years driving.
I suppose that's sort of like the signs in Marrakesh that tell you how many camel days it takes to cross the Sahara.
Yes, right. Not how many feet it is. But I have to try to talk to people in a language which their guts can understand. See, we get fail-safe sun telescopes out in the sidewalks for people to see the sunspots. And I have to tell them that the sun is so big that there's room inside of it for the moon to orbit the Earth with 250,000 miles left to spare. It's not easy for people in their guts to understand how big the sun is or how far away it is.
John Dobson, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Don't thank me.
John Dobson is an astronomer and a teacher, and he may have a telescope near you someday.
Of the night, as I gaze from my window at the moon in its flight, my thoughts all stray to you. In the still of the night, while the world is in slumber, all the
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us from All Things Considered. You've got something coming up from Albuquerque, Noah.
That's right, Frank. I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we have special reporting this week for the All Things Considered 20th anniversary celebration. Linda Wertheimer's in Chicago, and Robert Siegel has stories from New York City. And I'm in New Mexico with conversations today with four young people who want to make a difference in the state. One wants to be a game warden. One wants to be a writer. There's a high school dropout who's become a political activist, and a young woman who started a self-esteem program as a way to fight teenage pregnancy. And we'll be hearing about their plans and their hopes for their future in New Mexico.
Thanks, Noah. Those and other stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. These days, with war still in the air, march music tends to have political overtones. Marches are labeled either patriotic or militaristic, depending upon your point of view. But the recent release of an album titled The Original All-American Sousa suggests to classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz that marches can also be judged on their musical merit. The album includes performances by Keith Bryan and his new Sousa band. But Lloyd says its most remarkable feature is the series of six recordings made 70 years ago by the original March King himself.
Most serious classical music lovers probably don't have the same affection for marches as they do for other kinds of lighter music. Waltzes, for instance, also keep to one rhythm, but three-quarter time is more interesting than 4/4, and marches just don't have the same romantic appeal. Love is a more interesting and complex emotion than militant patriotism. But this new album of Sousa marches reveals a greater variety than marches are usually credited with. Of course, the album includes the famous ones like Stars and Stripes Forever, Semper Fidelis, and the U.S. Field Artillery March, better known as The Caissons Go Rolling Along. We're told in the informative historical notes that for the artillery march, Sousa used an army tune composed just after the turn of the century by Edward L. Gruber. This performance by Keith Bryan and the new Sousa band keeps with Sousa's frequent practice of ending with pistol shots. Sousa's marches weren't all intended for marching. Some were concert pieces like the delightful Grand March, The Pride of Pittsburgh, which here gets its world premiere recording. It was written for the Pittsburgh Exposition in 1901 to honor two Pittsburgh composers, Stephen Foster and Ethelbert Nevin. Sousa quotes two of their tunes in witty counterpoint, Foster's Come Where My Love Lies Dreaming, and Nevin's still familiar Narcissus. There are also marches Sousa based on melodies from his operettas. He wrote 15. And there's one with a Middle Eastern flavor called Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, which was written as a tribute to his Masonic lodge. Hundreds of recordings were made by the so-called Sousa Band, but the Victor Talking Machine Company released only six actually conducted by Sousa himself. Each was made immediately after the marches themselves were composed, between 1917 and 1923. All six are on this new Delos CD. Here's Sousa's own 1923 recording of Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. There's also a speech that Sousa made on a radio program sponsored by Bond Bread on November 6, 1929, his 75th birthday. He died 2.5 years later.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. This is John Philip Sousa, and I'm very glad to be here with my band representing my own country, America, on this international program. When the Bond Bakers asked me to transcribe my voice and my band for this unique occasion, I was greatly honored because I realized, as Mr. Taylor has said, that some of the finest bands in the world have been engaged to play for you. I hope, however, that you will enjoy hearing me again as much as I always enjoy playing for you. I've been asked to begin with a march that is an old favorite of mine. Maybe you will recognize it.
Here's John Philip Sousa's own buoyant live broadcast performance of that old favorite. By the way, Sousa also wrote words about the American flag to his memorable tune. Let despots remember the day when our fathers with mighty endeavor proclaimed as they marched to the fray that by their might and by their right it waves forever.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the original All-American Sousa on the Delos label. Fresh Air's technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee, with research assistance by Ellen Silva. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus. He represented Viking Press in 3 landmark cases which tested an author's right to portray fictional and non-fictional characters. I'm Frank Browning. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.